Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The election's coming. Well, it's been and gone, but whoever's in charge of the ship, it's still going the wrong way. So we do what we do occasionally here, and that is look back to find out how we got where we are today. What went wrong? Today is the 70th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. The war with Japan in the Pacific carried on through May, June and July 1945 until US bombers dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August the 6th and the 9th, 1945. Japanese surrender was announced on the 15th of August and signed on the 2nd of September 1945, 70 years ago. But what really happened to the keepers of the Nazi purse strings here in Europe? We know that Hitler had looted hundreds of millions in gold, securities and art treasures and other valuables. Did it all just disappear? Is it still lying in some Swiss bank vault somewhere? Or was it secretly reinvested after the war? Also, we heard here that rather too many of the key personnel in ISIS have been supplied via the Penny Lane block at Guantanamo Bay by the Pentagon. Also, it seems Mohammed Emwazi, known as Jihadi John, has been turned from a peace-loving, moderate English Muslim into a crazed ISIS killer at the hands of no other than our own MI6. So, would it surprise you to learn the CIA and the Pentagon are funneling terror money for ISIS through Swiss bank accounts? We hear this week from US Army whistleblower Scott Bennett. And finally, the battle for your mind and the establishment stranglehold on the power of the media with Bullingdon Club member David Dimbleby and former chairman of the Young Conservatives Nick Robinson. They're giving us their commentary from the BBC studio floors. HSBC and BAE Systems, they're money launderers, aren't they, HSBC, directing the corporation from the chair now, and the vice chair of the BBC. This is really unprecedented in the corporation's history. From the boardroom, is there any hope of fair coverage of the affairs of the nation? Plus, we go and have a look around some of the world's hotspots. But to begin with, Martin, it's VE Day. That is 70 years ago, the end of the war in Europe.
Yes, and it's still politicised as we speak because there was a victory parade in Moscow to which many world leaders went, but many didn't, because we're rowing over VE Day.
Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because let's have a look at some of the figures of the numbers of people that died in World War II. Soldiers and civilian deaths, that is. In Germany, the Germans lost 9 million. The Italians, 460,000. Britain lost 450,000. America, 420,000. Americans lost a few less than Britain. But the Soviet Union lost a colossal 24 million people in the Second World War. Poland actually lost 5.5 million.
Yeah.
So actually, in a way, you know, it's surprising, isn't it? We tend to think of the Allies being the Britain and then America, and them actually bearing the brunt of the war. Actually, the Soviets. I mean, looking at the figures, it's 50 times more people in the Soviet Union died than over here,
right,
and America combined.
Well, you can imagine the view from, you know, just the common sense view from Russia is that the US doesn't really understand warfare. They've never actually had any attacks on their home soil apart from 9/11, and there are all sorts of questions about that, which killed 3,500 people.
There are also
25 million.
20 million died in World War II in China. Of course, they were fighting the Japanese, who lost 3 million. A total in the entire war of 60 million dead.
Yes, and if you think about the wars which we have fought in my lifetimes, directly and indirectly, you can add millions to that. Millions in Vietnam, at least a million in Iraq, probably. And it goes on, and so it goes on. It's a very sad and a moment for somber reflection, I think.
Yeah, there's a book came out a few years ago called Grey Wolf, and it purports to show that Adolf Hitler survived the bunker at the end of World War II. Hugh Trevor Roper, it was the MI6 agent, officer actually, that wrote the story about what happened at the Hitler bunker at the end of World War II, 70 years ago. That book, Grey Wolf, has done very, very well. But some of the books haven't done so well and hardly known about. In fact, when the book was originally published, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, back in 1982, Paul Manning, who wrote it, his brother was shot dead in New York, his publisher had his legs broken. This book's hardly known about. And I'd just like to quote from that, Martin, in a minute. But first of all, give us just the context here. Who was this Martin Bormann character? Because there's quite a lot of contesting over the years since World War II about whether he really died at the bunker or not.
Well, I mean, who was Bormann? He was effectively Hitler's go-to man to fix things. So he was the guy who had controlled access to Hitler.
Well, he's a chief of staff as well.
Yeah, well, it was more informal than that. Hitler, basically, was not very good on detail or planning. He used to just have great thoughts, and Bormann would put them into practice for him, although, of course, Bormann, in fact, in his own quiet way, was actually running the show, particularly the finances.
Now, Hitler had this favourite trick, didn't he? In fact, many business managers now use this trick, which is to have two deputies or maybe two people who are supposed to be doing the same job, with the idea that those two people will then start really competing for the favours of the boss. Yeah. This was the case with Martin Bormann and also the chap that came across here to Britain.
Rudolf Hess.
Now, once Hess had come and flown over to Britain in his Messerschmitt for this kind of... he was attempting, wasn't he, to persuade the British to actually make an alliance with Germany and attack Soviet Russia before the Barbarossa attack.
Yes, and it didn't come off for whatever reason. I think Hitler's style was, in fact, to have competing, you know, everybody competing for his attention. But Bormann actually decided who got to see Hitler and who didn't. And he was heartily disliked by the rest of them, but he was in a very, very strong position. And Paul Manning, in his book, basically makes the point that Bormann was the brains behind the Nazi Party.
And, of course, with Hess out of the way, Bormann had Hitler to himself. He had a free rein, pretty much. Anyway, one of the things that Paul Manning says in his book is looking at the Jewish participation in these companies that Bormann was setting up. Now, Bormann set up from South America, mostly from Argentina. We've spoken to Lawrence de Mello on this show as well, because she's an English journalist over in Argentina that's been looking into this quite a lot as well. These 750 companies were actually being run from the jungle. They were originally set up, and then those companies were given money which had been laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York.
Yeah, well, I mean, also, basically, Bormann was allowed to go to Argentina, according to John Ainsworth Davis in the book Op JB. I can't remember what his pen name was when he wrote it.
Christopher Crichton.
Crichton. People who listen to the show regularly, we know this is a story we've been pursuing for some time. The point is that various Nazi, serious people like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, became part of NATO's infrastructure. So you've actually got, as the Russians are quite keen to point out these days, that NATO at its birth was using all of these Nazi operatives. Now, Bormann was too high level to be openly brought back in like Gehlen was, but basically a nod and a wink left him safely enough in South America. And of course, you know, the kind of tactics which modern Western psychological warfare officers use are modelled on those of the Nazis, but more sophisticated.
Anyway, just a quote from Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And Paul Manning had been working for CBS News during World War II, broadcasting to the whole of America almost daily about the progress of the war in Europe. So much emphasis, he says, is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, that was in South America, wasn't it? It produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities of Buenos Aires, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bormann was a sort of equal opportunities thug. He was a very talented gangster, really, and the Nazi Party was his vehicle. And so from his point of view, after the war, he's perfectly prepared to work with Jewish people. He's got no particular problem with them as long as they're rich enough.
Jewish leaders, he says, inform the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again. That is to say, the Israeli Secret Service kidnapping Nazi war criminals in South America and bringing them back for trial in Israel, because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America, as well with the Bormann organisation, and cut off the flow of Jewish money back to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, Bormann was eventually survives the war, and, you know, his fingers are in all sorts of pies. And so sort of Mossad had training from his operatives and so on. I mean, it's not that surprising if you think about it. I mean, basically, deals are done behind the scenes. At the end of World War II, the picture is becoming increasingly clear that there was a faction in the West that was determined to continue the war against the Soviet Union in collaboration with selected members of the previous setup in Germany. And so they, you know, but we all know about the rocket scientists, but it's the intelligence officers that were the real gold here, because anyway, they knew where the gold was buried.
I mean, this pursuit of Nazi war criminals by the Mossad and the Israelis never happened again. That's what Paul Manning says here, and the pursuit of Bormann quietened down at the request of the Jewish leaders.
Yeah, I mean, deals were being done, basically.
And he writes this in 1982 when he published the book. He said Bormann's residing in an Argentinian safe haven protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history, as well as by all those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. Now, I mean, this is, to some people, will be fantastical stuff, Martin, but what to you it gives it the ring of truth?
Well, if you read Paul Manning's book, he was a top-flight war correspondent during World War II. There's a lot of name-dropping in the book, because he makes sure that you realise that he knew all of the principals, Roosevelt, Churchill, Eisenhower. He was an intimate with all of them. So he's that level of person. So when he says something like this, it's got to be taken seriously, because he put a lot of research into it. And I know from other things that I've read, and we all know, I mean, as I've mentioned frequently, Reinhard Gehlen was the head of the Gestapo. He then becomes the head of the West German Intelligence Service, the BND. Now, you couldn't make it clearer. The head of the Gestapo becomes head of the follow-on so-called Democratic Intelligence Service. You know, that sends a fairly clear signal to the Russians, doesn't it?
He stayed in a plantation, apparently, Bormann, but his stay in the plantation finally ended, and Bormann was moved again to the high mountains of Argentina that border Chile. The hue and cry had died down, and occasional journalists would take up the hunt, but would be tracked by Mueller's men. So he had this guy, Mueller, in Buenos Aires, who was running a whole intelligence operation to make sure that anybody around who was actually coming quite close to Bormann was tracked, and by one reason or another, steered away.
Well, Klaus Barbie, who escaped to Latin America, eventually was brought in as a contractor by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. So you've got some Nazis, if you like, who are kind of escaping under their own steam and using these kind of Odessa-style networks. But it was all possible because very senior people in the Western intelligence and military infrastructure wanted it to happen. And, you know, I'm thinking now of the Dulles brothers and so on. And you mentioned Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm. And the tip of the iceberg of this has long been known. Operation Paperclip brought, you know, people of Nazis of interest to the US, into the US. And this is how gangsters work. I mean, whoever they are, you know, you either beat them or you join them. And gradually, you know, and the whole logic of concentration in official markets is even more powerful in illegal markets, where there's no kind of competition authorities, and you can aspire to being a monopoly if you work hard enough at it.
Well, it's a terrific read. Reads like a thriller. It's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the former CBS wartime news correspondent Paul Manning, published in 1982.
It's getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And as I said at the top of the hour, we hear rather too many of the key personnel in ISIS have been supplied via this Penny Lane block at Guantanamo Bay by the Pentagon. Martin, we have heard quite a lot about this, haven't we? Penny Lane block, just remind us what it is, because quite a lot of the personnel, I mean, I noticed, for example, the other day that the communications officer for ISIS, the chief of communications, went to LA film school.
Yes, odd, isn't it? Well, the Penny Lane is slang for the two parts of Guantanamo Bay. There is Strawberry Fields, where you are basically kept forever, and Penny Lane, where you go off back into the field as agents of the Americans. And it's fairly clear to me that the so-called principals in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who had been in Guantanamo, went to Yemen and set up AQAP, were working as agents of the Americans. I mean, the Iranians have said pretty openly that's what's the case. They're also pointing out that the AQAP is now having the Saudis dropping weapons to it in order to help it fight the Houthi insurgency inside.
So hang on, this is a little bit deja vu here, because again it looks like the US and the Brits actually are helping Al-Qaeda here.
Yes, and of course at the low level where people are being scared out of their wits by all of this, it's all, isn't it terrible, what are we going to do about these terrible people beheading people, etc., although the beheading videos have been substantially debunked as, you know, essentially theatre. Not that there's not lots of nasty things going on, there certainly are. I mean, it's becoming clearer and clearer. I mean, a Russian advisor of Putin the other day said that ISIS had been trained by the Israelis. The Iranians have been saying that, American planes and British planes have been dropping weaponry to the people they claim to be fighting. Now, it's very hard for people to get their head around this. Why would you drop weaponry to people you claim to be fighting? Surely they wouldn't be that devious. And I'm afraid people in the Middle East are just wiser about this stuff than we are. They live in a world in which that kind of thing is not only possible, it's actually virtually inevitable.
Well, one of the big new roles in the military, well, it's certainly grown since World War II, is psychological warfare. And recently, a chap has surfaced in the United States, a guy called Scott Bennett. I think the thing that makes him fascinating was, I mean, for example, he was giving information to Michael Hastings just before Michael Hastings died mysteriously. This is a US journalist. But one of the things he said is that he's given some top secret information, which is apparently very explosive, to some top lawyers and top journalists over in the United States. So if anything happens to him, that's going to be, he hopes, made public. So why is it so significant that these, you know, some quite senior psychological warfare officers come out and started to talk about the kind of work he's been doing? I mean, he's saying here that he was tracking flows of money from the CIA through Swiss banks and straight into ISIS and Islamist terror groups in the Middle East.
Well, why is it important? Because it's all very well for us to make allegations, but this is an insider who has proof. We don't need to look into all the detail to know the general pattern of what's going on. I think it's fairly obvious to those who pay more and passing attention that this is how these things are done. But it's always good to get it from the horse's mouth, isn't it?
And here he is, Scott Bennett, a former psychological warfare officer in the US Army, speaking to Dave Hodges on the Common Sense Show. And he talks about Michael Chertoff. Do you want to just mention, maybe, before he starts?
Head of Homeland Security and dual Israeli American citizen. And definitely in the frame for various nefarious things.
And this here, Scott describes really his, I suppose, career trajectory, how he started working in psychological warfare.
My background had been in advertising, so I knew how to target messaging to the Islamic mind. So that naturally inclined me into the military world of psychological warfare. So Booz Allen Hamilton had contacted me through one of their top generals, a guy named General Jeff Jones, who was basically the Merlin of psychological warfare. He was renowned as, quote, the father of modern PSYOP, and he had been around for a long, long time and written a lot, and he had contacted me and said, you know, Scott Bennett, I like you, I like your writing, I like your attitude, because he saw me sort of dress down Donald Rumsfeld and General Myers at a Pentagon meeting one time, and I had that videotaped, and I had stood up and made some questions on PSYOP to General Myers and Donald Rumsfeld. And General Jones liked how I did that. It was fearless. It was bold. I wasn't looking to make their friendship. I didn't have any care what they thought. I just hit them with the truth. And they agreed with my premise. So that's when Colonel Jones contacted me and brought me aboard Booz Allen Hamilton. And he said, you're going to be developing psychological warfare theories. You're going to be developing all sorts of platforms for winning the war. And we need creative people to step in and enhance the bureaucratic mind that runs the military right now. So he was a kindred spirit. So I jumped into Booz Allen Hamilton thinking I was going to do some really great work. And I did. But the problem was the defense contractor really didn't want to win the war. It was like, okay, well, all we need to do is throw this pass, we'll score a touchdown, we'll win the game. All we need to do is throw this big bucket of water on this fire and it'll go out. But Booz Allen Hamilton didn't want that. They wanted to keep the fire going. They wanted to keep the game going endlessly. And that struck me as a moral compromise, to say the least. And the cost was guys getting killed, kids going to war and wearing uniforms and getting maimed and crippled and blown up by this never-ending war. But I found that at State Department. I found that at Special Operations Command. I hadn't even gone into the 9/11 issues. I never even discovered a lot of that material and the research and the experts that were behind it until well after 2010, 2011. But I discovered all this sort of accidentally in Booz Allen Hamilton. And when I was down at U.S. Central Command, tracking the money sources, tracking the money supplies and the banks and the couriers and the wealthy donors and the governments that were involved. And I can't go into a lot of those operations, but I kept going into my work like a fight, like a war we're trying to win. And I kept finding guys trying to stop me, trying to say, well, we're not going to do that without a new contract. We're not going to do that without more money. And I'm saying to myself, how can you not do this? How can you not give this commander this material? He's asking us for this. We can do it. Let's do it for him. No, we're not doing anything more until we revise our contract and this and that. And it was the most disgusting thing I encountered. Now, I ran counter to that instruction. I was delicate and diplomatic. But I didn't obey a lot of that instruction. I found ways to get my recommendations and research into the hands of commanders. But it was soon after I started doing that that my boss, Dove Zakheim, who you might know from being the Pentagon comptroller who lost $2.3 trillion, Dove Zakheim...
Right, I should say right before 9/11.
Yeah. Dove Zakheim was the comptroller right before 9/11 who had... quote, misplaced $2.3 trillion, as well as sold a lot of armaments to Israel. He's a rabbi, Dov Zakheim. He's got a dual citizenship with Israel. And he was the man who was right in deep with the Pentagon, where the auditors were. They had a whole team of army auditors tracking this money down, which was the part of the Pentagon that was incidentally hit. So it was quite bizarre that the room that all these army auditors were in that were tracking the money supply that had gone missing were all killed. And one of them was not. And it was funny. He was put in charge of some part of the 9/11 commission, I remember. So the more I started digging into this, I found some real ugly stuff. But not to digress, but Dov Zakheim was my boss down at U.S. Central Command. And when I think when he started really seeing my temperament, what I was doing, and where my allegiance was, which was to the American people and the military mission, not to the defense contractor, not to this whole scam of 9/11, that's when he fired me. That's when they orchestrated a false paperwork error on my military housing form and turned it into a federal charge and prosecuted me with it and threw me into a federal prison. Dov Zakheim was directly connected. He was my boss. He hired me and he fired me. And he was directly connected with the whole Pentagon 9/11 issue, as well as the SPS, the plane remote control systems, as well as buying 767s and converting them into tankers and selling them to foreign governments. I mean, there's all sorts of really smelly stuff that you just know there's something not right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Zakheim for a second. Dual citizenship with Israel. This has in part led to many people approaching me and telling me that Mossad was also involved in 9/11. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I would say absolutely. There's been some wonderful experts that I think are brilliant in their analysis of the Mossad involvement. I know for a fact, I mean, Booz Allen Hamilton had a lot of Mossad agents in it. Booz Allen Hamilton had an entire floor in its McLean, Virginia headquarters and its Reston headquarters where it had top secret documents stored. So a government contractor has top secret documents from the United States government stored inside of a civilian building. and you've got Mossad operatives inside as defense contractors. So basically, they have access to all of the top secret documents that their contractors can pull out of the federal agencies that they're assigned to. That's how it works.
That's quite a fascinating insight, in a way, Martin, with all these top secret documents kept in a private defense contractor, and then a foreign intelligence agency can just go through them at will.
Well, yes. I mean, the military-industrial complex is way out of control, and not just because it likes wasting money on prestige projects. They are actually fomenting evil and war, and somebody's going to have to stop them sooner or later.
So how is it that people responsible for defence and part of the military, the armed forces, surely there must be somebody in there, you know, a senior officer somewhere, who says, no, actually, it's not a good idea to pass all those top secret documents to a private contractor where then they're wide open.
No, but I mean, don't forget that the private contractor is probably connected to the people making the decision, who also have friends and colleagues who are working within these structures. I mean, the CIA is no longer a kind of line-managed public sector body. It's a series of a nest of hundreds of independent companies which don't talk to each other ostensibly and are basically running the policy from behind the scenes. I don't think you don't need to know all the detail to get the general picture. And of course, the politicians are either completely corrupted by this process or just kept at arm's length from it and treated as Boy Scouts.
This Dov Zakheim guy, though, does go right back to 9/11, doesn't it? Because he was, I think it was $2 trillion was being tracked by people in the Pentagon. They had a little office in the Pentagon that was doing it, and that office was destroyed, demolished by a missile or a plane, whatever hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, that's right. Now, what people have just got to get the basic idea. Psychological warfare is being carried out. I mean, even in the mainstream, we've been told that we're going to have a British cyber battalion of thousands of officers who will spend their time thinking up scams for social media to get the war to take the war to ISIS or whatever. And of course, as the Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff have pointed out, you are part of that psychological warfare. The ISIS is part of your psychological warfare game.
The new British Army unit is called Brigade 77.
Brigade 77. I wonder where they got that from. Now, the point is that it's been presented to everybody in the general media as they're going to be working to try and stop extremism from taking root, blah, blah, blah. But in actual fact, we know for a fact that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, has intimate relationships with Western intelligence services going back for years. Years and years and years. And yet we're then told, oh, these Islamists have taken over in Libya. How awful it is. Well, we're going to have to do something to stop that. But nevertheless, we armed and trained these very people. And on one level, we're told, oh, well, we did arm and train them in the past in Afghanistan and Syria and all these other places. But then they kind of got out of control and we couldn't stop them anymore. And the Saudis say the same thing. You know, well, we did give loads of money to Islamic extremists in Syria, but we couldn't control them once we'd given it to them. It's really sorry. We're going to have to do something about it now. I don't believe that these groups are not under control. Turkey and Saudi Arabia have just come to an agreement to fund the opposition, military opposition inside Syria, to try and topple Assad. The Booz Allen Hamilton and all these chaps are all over in Ukraine, busily trying to retrain the rabble that is the Ukrainian armed forces, so that they can restart the war in the Donbass. This is the kind of thing that should have been discussed in our general election campaign. But it wasn't.
Okay, Brigade.
From Nicola Sturgeon.
Let's just look at our own homegrown psychological warfare people. This Brigade 77, the idea is to use it. I mean, this is what we're told anyway. You're never quite sure whether the military are telling you the truth, but they're saying they use it on Facebook and Twitter and other forms of social media. So that's apparently where these... Well, what are they doing on these things? Are they deleting things? Or what are they up to
media? You can do all sorts of things. You can monitor people at the very least, and then you can start to, you know, creating rows and arguments within groups that you're targeting. You can recruit people online to go to Syria and say, oh, look, this terrible woman's just gone to Syria. As we found out, the Turkish police arrested a British teenager who'd just gone to Turkey to go into Syria, and they arrested the guy who'd recruited her. Turned out he was a Canadian intelligence officer. That's the reality. And at the same time, that the lies are becoming so large that it's impossible to see the end of them. But I think what's happening is, of course, this kind of bullying technique is making the rest of the world wake up to the point that they cannot really ignore it anymore.
To look at it from the Army's point of view for 1 minute, at least what they say is that it's non-lethal warfare, this. When they get online, what they're doing is they're trying to fight for hearts and minds, but they're not actually killing anyone.
Well, that's delusionary. In actual fact, it involves both things. I mean, we had Stephen Dorrell here talking about the SAS's role in Iraq. So MI6 find out everything they want to do about their targets, and then somebody goes out and rubs them out. It's not the MI6 officers. They've got other grunts to do that. The war is raging in Syria. We are involved in it. We are involved in the war in Yemen. But we all want to come home and have a nice cup of tea. Did you see, incidentally, by the way, that an ex-IRA guy was shot dead in Belfast this week? Not clear who carried it out, but, you know, it could be somebody in the intelligence services setting in a score, because that's the real world.
Now, you mentioned Syria there, and we will go back to Scott Bennett in a minute, but you mentioned Syria. Pretty shocking article in The Independent this week on Tuesday. Syria's circle of hell. Aleppo residents describe children without heads, streets filled with blood, and injuries never before witnessed by surgeons. It's Aleppo, this is in Syria, witnesses bodies of decapitated children and body parts lining the streets in a harrowing report detailing the unthinkable atrocities endured by those living through the civil war. In a damning report, Amnesty accused all parties in the conflict of violating international humanitarian law and committing grave abuses of human rights that have seen civilians hit by the worst of the violence. Human rights groups said armed opposition groups such as Al-Nusra Front had abducted nearly 1,000 individuals, 142 of them children, sometimes tortured and forced to pay fines in order to secure their release.
Well, that's right. These are our allies. Or were our allies, and we're now training more moderate rebels in Syria at taxpayer expense. I've mentioned this before, but Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was on French TV. It's on the record. He said before the Arab Spring, before the war in Syria, he was approached by British officials in London who said to him, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" And I think with hindsight, it's now absolutely clear that NATO intelligence services, working with the GCC, the Gulf dictatorships and the Turks, have fomented a civil war in Syria, which they can't finish off because they can't win it. Incidentally, when the Egyptians rise up against their military government, I'm quite sure the RAF will be bombing the Egyptian army, won't they? Because that's what we do. We do revolution in Libya and Syria, but not in Egypt and not in Saudi Arabia, right?
But of course, you can't really control these forces once you invoke them. Right now in Syria, and we sort of hoped that Assad was actually regaining control of the country and that there was going to be less, but it seems that, you know, for cities like Aleppo, this is just going on and on. And the question has to be, is this really just a sort of second attempt using ISIS as a kind of vector to topple Assad?
Absolutely. And then in fact, the right-wing politicians in the US are absolutely clear that even though they're going after ISIS, they're going after Assad as well, which of course doesn't make any sense at all. If you want to stop ISIS, the Syrian Arab army has taken 60,000 casualties fighting these mostly non-Syrian mercenaries put in there by NATO and the Gulf Cooperation Council. Now, if the British want to get involved in a fight like that, is the British army prepared to take 60,000 casualties? Because if we're not, perhaps we should walk by on the other side of the road.
Well, maybe this is why they've employed the 777 Brigade for psychological warfare, so that hopefully this will, you know, mean that actual armed conflict isn't necessary.
I don't believe that for a minute. This is if you were going to set something like that up, you shouldn't tell everybody that you're doing it. It's a PR stunt, and I just do not believe NATO intelligence services, over the last few years in particular, have proved beyond all doubt in my mind that they are involved in terrorism. They are the terrorists, by and large. And a lot of these so-called lone wolf attacks are being directed in classic style, running back to Italy in the 1960s and 1970s.
I suppose, Martin,
absolutely the pattern.
The obvious thing to do is to be really, really, like, quite draconian about it and say no defence contractors, no private companies
absolutely
involved.
Absolutely. There's
business.
No case whatever in my mind for private companies to be involved in military business. Military is not, it's not a very competitive market. I mean, you want a monopoly of force by the legitimate state.
The idea of war and the profit motive don't sit very happily together, do they?
Well, they do, but they shouldn't.
Okay, well, let's go back and have another listen now, another clip, and I'll put the link to the full, I think it's 2 hours altogether, interview on the Common Sense Show with Scott Bennett. And this time he's questioning, you know, it actually seems like there's some sort of cooperation between the Israeli state and ISIS.
You don't see Israel being overtaken by ISIS. You don't see videotapes of them pounding and going in and making claims about destroying the, you know, the Israeli Jewish presence there, because they're given aid and comfort in hospitalization by some of the Israeli operations. So the media never really talks about it. But those are the facts. You start bringing the pieces of the puzzle together, and you see very clearly their fingerprints, their involvement, their tactic of trying to bring in the U.S. using false flag operations. They tried to do it in France. Everyone knows who watches the video of that terrorist leaping over the French police officer after he shoots him knows it was a blank, because there was no skull or bones or blood that came out the other side of the guy's head when he was supposedly shot. And I know from military, when you're shot with a 7.62 weapon, you don't have much of a head left. It's easy for most Americans to kind of let that go. They don't see it. They don't really pay attention. They just digest what they're fed.
So, Martin, you know, it does look as if there may be even some sort of secret alliance, at least according to what Scott's saying there, between the Israelis and ISIS. Is that real?
I'm absolutely sure it is real. I've read a lot about it. Everybody in the Middle East knows. If you read the press in Lebanon, for example, they will be absolutely clear about this. The Iranians have made their feelings clear about this from the very beginning. We are being given a very, very sanitized version of what is going on and who is doing what to who. And, of course, the things we are supposed to care about, Syria bad enough, are we being told about the repressions going on in Egypt? No. Do we know what's going on in Saudi Arabia? Not a clue. The only people who get accused of this, that and the other are the people we don't like. The people we do like are allowed to do whatever they like. And the Saudis and others in the Gulf are undoubtedly the main supporters of ISIS, at the very least. And of course, they work very closely with our own military. The Saudi military are trained at Sandhurst, as are all of these people.
And it's also important to point out that the Amnesty report also criticises Assad. You know, he says their report found residents living in opposition-controlled areas of Aleppo had experienced aerial bombardment campaigns launched by Syrian government forces too. Attacks which Amnesty said largely involved the use of devastating barrel bombs made from oil barrels, fuel tanks or gas cylinders filled with explosives and fragments of metal.
Listen, wars like that, I was an aid worker in Bosnia, wars like that are pretty brutal. There aren't any good guys and there aren't any bad guys in general. That's why you should try and avoid them if possible. And of course, in actual fact, the British and the Americans have been killing loads of civilians in Syria with their much more high tech than barrel bombs. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, who are anti-Assad, have said that loads and loads of civilians have been killed by our aircraft in the last week. Are we going to cry about that? Are we going to overthrow the government? Should we go to the Court of Human Rights? Question, isn't it?
Well, there's also been a lot of civilians dying in Yemen too, haven't there?
Indeed.
Also, though, our next clip from Scott Bennett, former psychological warfare officer in the US Army. He is talking a bit about how he discovered some of the connections to the Swiss banks and money was, it seemed, going from the CIA in the United States and through these banks to ISIS. And it does sort of back up some of the suggestions I've been making and looking at that. Hang on a minute, this is quite a complex corporation, effectively. Yeah. ISIS, isn't it? And
indeed.
Surely, I mean, for example, if money is being paid into bank accounts as fines, as we were hearing, or bribes or whatever earlier to get people out of custody, I mean, surely those accounts could be shut down. But anyway, let's see what Scott's got to say.
The key is, of course, all the architects and engineers and scientists who live and breathe concrete and steel and architectural designs, all of whom are saying with absolute fearless integrity, this was not, and it was physically impossible, according to the laws of the universe, for this building to have come down in the way the official story tries to explain it.
Here he is talking about Building 7 on 9/11.
People's intelligence. And it's even worse than that. It's treason. It's covering up of murder. Everyone should know that it was absolutely a false flag and it was an engineer. Now, you walk away after discovering the what happened, the buildings being exploded and the thermite and all the other molten metal and things like that. That's an easy one. Yeah, it was destroyed purposely. It wasn't done by planes. It was done by explosives and things like that. But then you walk away with why? Who did it and why? And then the Americans should be saying, well, you know what? I shouldn't have to figure that out. My congressman and senator was elected to figure that out. He's in the key position. He's got the authority to contact the government agencies that do this investigation. He's got the authority to walk into the Pentagon and demand an explanation from generals and military brass with top secret clearances. My congressman and my senator are in the position to investigate and report all that. But sadly and obscenely and absolutely treasonously, not one of them has done a single thing in this whole area. And I saw that personally when I reported to congressmen and senators that I discovered Swiss bank accounts and the Swiss banker who related to me and all of the Saudi Middle Eastern donors that were involved with using Swiss banks to fund terrorism. I reported what I knew and how it came to me, asking for debriefing, asking for the Senate and the Congress and the military to meet with me and meet with Birkenfeld and get all this on the table, because it had never been done. None of Birkenfeld's materials had ever been allowed to be seen by military authorities. And you know what? Not one congressman, not one senator, not one military official ever contacted me or debriefed me or contacted Birkenfeld and debriefed him. And that is the greatest act of treason that I can imagine, because that report went out September 25th, 2012. And since that date, how many kids have been killed? How many kids have lost their legs, lost their eyes, lost their faces, are in hospital beds as vegetables? How many mothers and fathers have no son or daughter anymore, or have a child that's just in a coma on a hospital bed? All because they've been killed either by ordnance, by a bomb, or by a bullet, or just in a helicopter crash. Because none of this stuff was ever analyzed. And none of these terrorist financing accounts from Switzerland have ever been stopped, have ever been turned off, have ever been reverse tracked. None of them. No one's done anything.
So, Martin, the evidence is quite clearly there, according to Scott, of these Swiss bank accounts being used. And in fact, in a way, it echoes our first item at the 6 o'clock news, isn't it? That the Swiss bank, the Bank for International Settlements, was financing Hitler right the way through the war, providing him with foreign exchange, and then has continued right to this very day. And Mark Carney, our present governor of the Bank of England, is straight from the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland.
Yeah, I mean, I think the accounts he's talking about will probably be private banks rather than the BIS. But I mean, if anybody doubts that we are involved in financing terrorism, they really need to just go out and look at the material that's available already in open source. We openly call for the overthrow of Assad. The former British ambassador to Syria, a guy called Ford, wrote an article in the run-up to the election saying, well, look, Cameron called openly for the overthrow of Assad, and then he wonders why various British young teenagers set off to carry out the policy that the government has set itself on. We are actually, and Cameron in particular, we are warmongers. That's what we are. And of course, the election campaign has been run on people's perception of their own security, and in a rather self-centred way. And at the same time, we're off around the planet starting trouble wherever we get the chance.
And I suppose one of the reasons that this hideous attack on the Yemeni people, I mean, it's not as if they've got some sort of despotic dictator there or something, like was alleged with places like Libya, etc. It's just Yemen, you know. Basically, it's a very poor country. The only way I imagine that this has been allowed to carry on is because it's against the background of all that's happening in Syria and ISIS, and that is considered to be a much bigger problem, and this is a lesser problem.
Oh, well, I mean, that's right. I mean, when the Saudi Air Force, with planes provided by Britain, for example, kills civilians, not with barrel bombs, because barrel bombs are a bit inefficient. I mean, proper bombs, the ones that really blow things to bits. They're using cluster munitions and white phosphorus, according to the Houthis. And this has all been supplied by us, and we are cheering them on.
And our jets. Yeah, you said they were built in Filton, but they weren't.
But
anyway,
they were built in Lancashire.
I mean, the point here being that what you've got is a whole new Saudi leadership with various people
Something
trying to prove
themselves.
as amazing sort of tough guys.
Yes, giddy simple minds with foreign quarrels, as Henry V puts it in Shakespeare.
I mean, it's incredible that they can actually get away with attacking a sovereign country like this. And although I'm not sure what the situation is with the ceasefire, I know U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry actually visited Saudi Arabia and he told them to turn the heat down.
No, what he said is change your PR. They're calling for a ceasefire, but the Houthis have to lay down their arms unconditionally. That is not calling for a ceasefire. That's a political trick.
I mean, the latest.
Just as I suspect that the so-called deal with Iran is a bit of a trick. They're lulling them into a false sense of security.
I mean, you do wonder.
The Israeli and Saudi and Brit Western jets hit them. But of course, the Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff are preparing for war. And people listening to this show should be aware of that.
And
we
also,
are
in the last
going
hour,
to war with these countries.
In the last hour, the Saudis have been warning civilians on the border to leave. Now, this suggests that they're going to bring an armed ground force into Yemen from Saudi Arabia.
Paradoxically enough, many of the ordinary soldiers in the Saudi army are from guess where? Yemen.
Saudi-led coalition also saying, this is Associated Press a couple of hours ago, carrying out airstrikes against Yemen's Shiite rebels, declared
they're
a rebel
Shiites, but yes,
a rebel stronghold along the kingdom's border, a military target, and gave the residents an ultimatum to leave the region by nightfall. This is the kind of thing that's happening there. Either get out by nightfall or we're going to blow you to pieces.
Gosh, it sounds like President Assad, who must go. Maybe the Saudi monarchy must go. Not 2 months' time, not through a negotiated process. They must stand down now. Otherwise, we're going to war, aren't we? That's what we did to Gaddafi.
And the is it Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Nayef? These are, I mean, apparently there's some rivalry going on within the Saudi royal family, and this
is
one of the reasons.
You can imagine what's going, the kind of thing that goes on there. Nothing to do with freedom and democracy, though.
Okay, I get back to our final clip with former psychological warfare officer in the US Army, Scott Bennett, now. And here he's describing one of the things he thinks is one of the biggest problems in the US, and one of the reasons that this is happening, is that you've got lots of senior people in the military and in the government who have dual citizenship with Israel. Now, this is something we were hearing about a few weeks ago, Martin, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there is a real problem in that the state of Israel has become so embedded into particularly the US military intelligence infrastructure that they are able to direct it at remote control. And it's not just me saying that. Professor James Petras says this, who's an old Marxist who doesn't really go in for conspiracy theories, but it's not really a conspiracy theory, it's pretty obvious. Obama is slightly bucking the trend here, but soon he is to be swept aside by others who will do the bidding of the Israeli general staff. But they're not the only general staff in the world. As I said, the Iranians and the Russians are preparing to fight. Are we ready out there in Radio Land? Everybody ready? Get your tin hats on.
Chertoff is now at the firm that represented Unibank of Switzerland and all sorts of other international European banks. Chertoff now works for them. And that's a fascinating little leapfrog path he's taken. And it also applies to Lanny Brewer. Lanny Brewer went to Covington Burling for the Department of Justice. You've got Eric Holder now working for J.P. Morgan Chase, which was also involved. So you've got a lot of the Israeli dual American citizens in the high levels of government that, quite frankly, I think is unconstitutional. You can't serve two masters. And how anybody can allow that law to exist without challenging it as unconstitutional is beyond me. That's one of the first things that should be brought up in a challenge, is that you cannot have a dual citizenship. You are either a citizen of the United States of America and prepared to serve when you're called to serve in a draft, or you are a member of another country. Because theoretically and technically, if there was a draft of sorts, these high-level dual citizens could simply go to their other country with all sorts of, you know, valuable intelligence. So that law is very bizarre, how it's been allowed to sneak under the door. But you've got the dual citizenship issue, the split loyalty, not even to open up the Pandora's box of Netanyahu and the other Israeli prime minister at the time of 9/11, both being from the military branch that dealt with assassination and special operations.
Well, he leaves us on quite an amazing note there, saying that Netanyahu, the Israeli president, used to work for the assassination branch at the intelligence services.
He's a thug, as are many of the other people that we've been talking about, including inside our own infrastructure.
Psychological warfare is actually pretty much a commercial thing as well, isn't it, Martin? Because I know a lot of people that get trained in psychological warfare, like Scott Bennett has been in the United States, then go into work in these kind of mega PR on steroids firms that do you know, much bigger strategic communications. They're called there's one called Strategic Communications Lab, SCL, for example.
Yeah,
and they will tell, say, a government, you want us to win an election for you? We'll do it by psychological warfare.
Yeah, well, there's an enormous amount of overlap involved in all of these things, as you can imagine.
But in the civilian world, the psychological warfare officers will get paid sometimes 10 times more what they'll get paid for by the military.
Yeah, but the point is that it's a great big boondoggle for everybody. All of these generals that are ordering more of this stuff that they want, you know, whether it's psychological warfare teams or nuclear missiles, then go onto the boards of the companies that supply these things, and you know, they all live high on the hog on the back of it.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Well, before the elections, quite a bit, we were playing extracts from an interview with Daniela Ganser. Now, this guy really is one of the world experts in this kind of thing. And also, bizarrely, of course, you know, you seem to have all the best stuff and all the worst stuff in Switzerland, Martin.
Well, Switzerland is an obvious place for these kind of deals and so on to be done. And Ganser is a Swiss academic who has exposed, effectively, over the years of his work, NATO's terrorist infrastructure.
So let's get his take on this kind of thing.
Yeah, because it's a fight for your mind which is going on. It's a fight for your heart, you know, and once it's possible to shock people into hate and into fear, you can ask them for, you know, give me 5% of the GDP for defense. And then people go, no, I need some money for my kids who go to school, and I want better schools. And then people go, no, you can't have better schools because the terrorists are out there and they're going to kill you. And then you go, I don't believe you. No, I don't want to give this money to the military-industrial complex who's bombed Afghanistan for 14 years. And what good have they done in Afghanistan? I mean, show me your record. I mean, what good have you done in Libya? I mean, it's a holy mess. And if you look at Iraq, another mess. So I think people are waking up and they're using their own head. I mean, the problem is that the mainstream media is not very good at giving a critical look at NATO and manipulated terrorism. It's quite scary. They usually just offer a very superficial narrative.
Now, as there he was talking to Julian Charles at The Mind Renewed. But Martin, he's really leaving one of his last comments there as an attack on the media over here. I mean, I started by talking about the new little formation that there is running the BBC, the BBC Trust, where you've got the chair being Rona Fairhead. She's on the risk committee still, and director of HSBC Bank, the money laundering bank, the LIBOR fixing bank, all these various other things, PPI, fraudulent bank. Essentially a criminal bank, and then also the vice chair is Roger Carr. He's the chairman of BAE Systems. These two people are the two people at the top of the BBC now.
Yes, and if you look at what the BBC says about conflicts like Syria and Ukraine, it's serious misdirection. For example, in relation to Ukraine, BBC Russia went to Ukraine to the site of the crash of MH17. They interviewed locals separately, who all said separately that they'd seen the plane shot down by the fighters from Kiev. They went back to Moscow, uploaded their report in Russian to BBC Russia's website, and then BBC London went absolutely nuts and took it down. Nobody in Britain heard anything about it, even though the BBC's own journalists had interviewed local eyewitnesses who said that the plane had been shot down by fighters from Kiev. But the mainstream of British public opinion is still bamboozled into believing that it was carried out by the rebels.
What's your views to how things are going to unfold in Ukraine? Now we've got British troops in there training the Kiev soldiers, and who are they training exactly?
Well, it's not quite clear. They're either training the mainstream military or they're training some of these paramilitary groups. I'm sure that both things will be going on, because we've been sending undercover people to train these people for years. So there's a senior right-wing Polish politician who's pointed out that the snipers at in Maidan were probably trained in Poland before they were infiltrated back into Ukraine. Well, there's potential for war. That's what it's about. And we are sleepwalking into it. And of course, war is the way that they're going to cover up the fact that the economy is going to go down the tubes.
But surely, I mean, the Russians, you've got to point the finger at them too for annexing Crimea. I don't think there's a lot of people who have a great deal of doubt about the referendum that took place in Crimea, where the Crimeans supposedly voted to stay with Moscow.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. But the point is that in actual fact, they've done recent opinion poll surveys in Crimea, and as you can imagine, 80% plus are very happy with the setup and glad that they're not in the Ukraine anymore, which has turned into a bloodbath.
Well, no, I don't imagine that. I would imagine they would most probably want to stay with their original government and not be annexed by Russia.
Well, the fact is that they don't. And then if I was living in Crimea, I'd be really thanking my lucky stars that I wasn't in the Ukraine, because the Western Ukrainian economy is tanking, the Eastern Ukrainian economy is in ruins. And of course, the potential for further conflict is definitely there, because there's a geopolitical reasoning behind all of this. Ultimately, the string pullers in Washington and London want to undermine Russia and China. That is their ultimate goal. And they're going to do it by way of Iran, then Russia, then China.
Final story, very quickly. The French judges have ended the inquiry into Yasser Arafat's 2004 death, apparently with polonium, just like Litvinenko. Anyway, that's all for this week. Time to sign off. The Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. Sister Show Dialect now at Wednesdays at noon this week. How to hear the bittern and have a lovely day out on the levels. Plus, the band Vicar talks about the Middle East before he was banned. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Steve Comer, former Lib Dem leader in Bristol. I'm online, Tony Gosling, at www.thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to Martin Summers, and don't let the banksters get you down. We'll be back next week.
It's 7 o'clock, live from Westminster, where, as some of his political opponents look for new party leaders, David Cameron is busy putting together a cabinet.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a majority Conservative government.
Most senior Tory ministers are staying in their position, including George Osborne as Chancellor and Theresa May as Home Secretary. The Lib Dems, Labour and UKIP are all looking for new leaders after the Tories claimed that overall majority in the House of Commons. Nick Clegg, Ed Miliband and Nigel Farage have all paid the price for not living up to expectations. Labour MP Tristram Hunt says it's too early to start thinking about a replacement.
Today's the day to think about still the colleagues we've lost in this election, those councillors who are still waiting for their results, and to think about what went wrong during this election campaign, because we'd rather have seen pictures of Ed Ball going into number 10 to think about what he wanted to do as Chancellor.
The opposite is true for Nicola Sturgeon. Her SNP claimed all but three of the seats in Scotland. In other news, the UK's paused to remember the end of World War II in Europe. 90-year-old Ken Hay served during the conflict and remembers how people treated him in 1945.
People were coming up and saying, "Give us a kiss, soldier," and that was rather nice. After the degradation we'd had with Jerry, it was rather fun to be treated as something for a while, you know?
There was a 2-minute silence on the 70th anniversary of VE Day at the Cenotaph in central London. An abandoned newborn girl has been found by police in the Republic of Ireland. She's been taken to hospital.